It's Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Here on Soundside, we've been talking a lot about how the city of Seattle will grow over the next 20 years or so. A 250,000 people could move here in that time, and Seattle has to make room for homes to house them. And growth can be disruptive when it comes to neighborhoods. Older homes get demolished to make way for a greater number of newer homes, homes that many people who live in the neighborhood cannot afford. That kind of pain is more disruptive in some neighborhoods than others. There are exceptions, of course, but statistically, people in a neighborhood like Laurelhurst have more resources to adapt to change than people in neighborhoods in the Rainier Valley. Parts of the Rainier Valley show up as bright spots on a heat map put out by the city of Seattle, highlighting something called displacement risk. Generally, the lower the average income in a neighborhood, the more risk that people will get evicted or foreclosed on as new homes are built there. KUOW's Joshua McNichols has been looking into what displacement risk looks like, how people are trying to fight it, and how thinking about displacement may be changing at the city government level. And he joins me now. Joshua, welcome.
Hey.
Okay, Joshua, you told me that before we jump into displacement that's happening now, you wanted to go back and start with a little history, right?
Yeah, because that perspective will be useful for understanding the present. I'm going to introduce you to Reginald Dennis, who was born in Seattle's central area and lives there today. He told me what it was like growing up in the neighborhood as an African-American in the 1960s and 70s.
I mean, it was a working class community, you know, and everybody I knew, their parents owned the homes that they were living in.
Dennis says the reason for this was something called redlining. Banks wouldn't loan money to purchase or fix up homes here because it was seen as declining. This racist practice also made homes unaffordable for black families. Later, as Seattle ran out of room to grow, white families and the banks that financed their purchases were drawn to the central area for its affordability. As a young man, Dennis could see where this was going to lead. He told his friends they would eventually leave.
And some of them would argue and say, well, I'm never going to sell. You know, I'm going to stay here. I said, well, I didn't try to argue with that. I said, maybe you will. Maybe you'll stay around. I said, but you'll watch your neighbors disappear one by one. And that's just what happened.
Hmm. Did Reginald Dennis say anything about what happened to all that black home ownership in the Seattle neighborhood where he grew up?
Well, he says people were priced out. A lot of black families had lower incomes, and even though redlining had technically ended, black families were at a disadvantage compared to white families when it came to getting loans to refinance or fix up their homes.
Yeah, got it. Banks doing their thing. I mean, even in recent years, data shows that black people and Latinos are denied conventional mortgages at a higher rate than white people, even when you control for factors like income and loan amount. What's the picture like now?
Okay, so fast forward to today, where something similar is happening in the southern end of the Rainier Valley, home to many black immigrant communities today. A lot of the families there are renters, but the displacement of black communities is similar. Fardosa Salat is a Somali-American who runs a small grocery store called Sharif Grocery and Halal on Rainier Avenue, and she's been watching as rents have risen in the neighborhood around her store. It's been driving her customers away.
We had a lot of customers that moved to Federal Way that we see once, and then when we ask, they'd be like, oh, we moved over there. Rent is too high.
What has that done to your business?
We lost customers.
How do you see your future as a store here, given all that's happening?
We wish in the best, but I don't know if this keep continuous. Maybe we will end up just being pushed away too.
Fardosa's situation reminds me that displacement isn't just about people losing their homes. It's also about losing the businesses that sustain people in a neighborhood, like a halal market. Did you talk to any of those customers?
Yeah, one customer who's trying to stay in the neighborhood, even as her rent rises. Her name's Hafsa Don. Before her rent went up, she and her sister were trying to get computer science degrees so they could go work at a company like Microsoft or Amazon. But what happened?
Because we're refugees. We literally just came here like 5 years ago, and we're trying to live on our own. So to pay the rent and the living and everything in America, we definitely need jobs. So I decided to find a job and let my sister finish her BA.
What kind of job did you find?
I work as a preschool teacher.
Which obviously doesn't pay as much as a tech salary. Recently, their rent went up a second time, and the two of them are trying to hang on because Moving to Federal Way would make their commutes much longer. So Hafsadan said she'd have to get a car if she did that, and she can't afford a car. Mm. So now her sister might also have to get a job too. So you can see how it becomes kind of a cascading catastrophe. You know, displacement causes just more and more things to go wrong for people who are just trying to improve their lives.
And the city loses this rich layer of our society when people like a preschool teacher and a student can't stay in town. So has Seattle made no progress on reducing this kind of displacement?
Well, there is a big difference between Seattle when the central area first gentrified and Seattle of today. Now the city and the state are investing a lot of money in subsidized affordable apartment buildings. We're talking about large buildings with lots of units on busy arterial streets. Many of these are in urban villages where the city channels most of its growth. I want to introduce you to someone else now, Sofia Benolfo. I met her outside of a new affordable apartment building under construction on Rainier Avenue. It's a project called Ethiopian Village, and it's 5 stories tall, and it's currently surrounded by scaffolding wrapped in fabric, the colors of the Ethiopian flag, you know, red, gold, and green.
So it's all about what we can do when we put our minds to it and work hard to get there.
Benolfo is the director of Ethiopian Communities of Seattle, and she says the community spent years organizing neighbors and lobbying politicians and chasing after grants and shaping the project.
When we started, it sounded more like a dream.
But that dream has now become 90 discount apartments targeted for Ethiopian seniors.
There is a lot of excitement in the community. We get calls asking us when they can register.
Wow, I mean, think of the lives that's going to change. It sounds like, Joshua, that Ethiopian Villages is a success story. And I know that there are many projects like that in the city now, like Yesler Family Housing or Filipino Community Village in Hillman City. Are they doing anything to ease displacement?
They are helping. I mean, the city currently helps subsidize over 15,000 affordable apartments, and about 22% of those are in South Seattle, in District 2. But those homes aren't abundant enough or cheap enough to help everybody. I met an Uber driver on Rainier Avenue named Maktoub Abdi, and he's been looking for an affordable apartment for his large family.
If you go down the Rainier here, if you go there, they say, oh, it's affordable house and stuff like that. But when you call them over, it's just same thing what we're paying right now. So that's not affordable housing. Yeah, affordable housing should be like something lower than that.
Abdi said affordable for him, for his wife and 3 kids, would mean a 3-bedroom apartment for $1,200.
Okay, so that's what affordability would look like for Abdi. How common is his experience?
Well, statistically, over a quarter of Black Seattle residents say they probably can't meet their next rent payment or mortgage payment. So that's a pretty sobering statistic.
Yeah.
And they are 10 times more likely to face eviction or foreclosure than their white neighbors. Recently, the amount of money for new buildings has been increasing, you know, as money flows in from taxes and fees earmarked for affordable housing. But Reginald Dennis, the guy we heard from earlier who grew up in the central area, warns of another problem with these new apartments.
I think it's not enough. You know, I can't see that it would lead to a dramatic change or that it would lead to any type of ownership in the community. A lot of these actions seem to be geared towards rental units and have nothing to do with establishing or trying to recreate a base.
So Dennis is calling out the status quo, where we look to subsidized apartments to solve the problem. He wants it to be easier for people on limited incomes to buy homes.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because he's touching on something that is such a huge systemic difference for Black Americans in this country. Why is home ownership rather than renting important?
Well, he's comparing it to what he grew up with, a place where people owned homes. And he said that was a vital part of what made that community thrive. We talked about the similarities between the erosion of the central area's Black community in Seattle and the destruction of what was called Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. In Tulsa, it was arson and murder that brought down that neighborhood where so many Black families had built up wealth. In Seattle, it was economics.
I think if I wanted people to know anything. I would want them to know the harm that the gentrification has caused, and that the impact of that has destroyed a viable, functioning community that really had the potential to grow.
And he says the same thing is happening now in the Rainier Valley today.
Generational wealth is achieved in most middle and upper class white American families through home ownership. And Reginald Dennis is seeing that goal getting further and further away for his community, which is replaying injustices of the past. Is anyone at the city level listening?
Yes. I mean, we are seeing a sea change in how officials talk about racist land use practices from the past. And you know, because we talked about it a lot in this program, that the city of Seattle is updating its comprehensive plan. And this is the first time they'll be going through that process since George Floyd was murdered and the protests that followed that. So Seattle planners appear to be taking seriously the need to examine how the city grows. And this time they're using a racial equity lens.
And what kinds of reforms could that lead them to?
Well, there's a growing recognition that the city's current growth strategy of channeling 83% of new housing into dense parts of the city called urban villages has not reversed the displacement of Black families and Latino families from the city. And it's also created another problem by turning low-density neighborhoods into exclusive enclaves and making it very difficult for people on lower incomes to afford homes there. The city considers this bad because those neighborhoods offer a lot of opportunities that would help low-income families improve their lives. You know, there's access to parks and schools and networking opportunities with neighbors, which can lead to job opportunities. I'm predicting what we're going to see come out of this is a two-pronged approach. More areas will be opened up to subsidized apartments like Ethiopian Village. And in order to increase opportunities for home ownership, some parts of the city that have been mostly off limits to development, areas dominated by single family homes, will be opened up a bit so that more affordable kinds of homes can be built there. So I expect we'll see those neighborhoods opened up to duplexes and triplexes and quads and townhomes, maybe small apartment buildings, depending on how far the mayor and the city council are willing to push this idea.
We're sure to see a lot of debate, a lot of pushback about the idea of opening up more dense development in those neighborhoods, as we have in the past. And I know, Joshua, you're going to be following that for us here on KUOW. Thanks very much for talking this through with us.
No problem.
The city of Seattle is taking public comment right now on how much it should rethink its current growth strategy as it updates its comprehensive plan. And the public comment period ends Monday at 5 p.m. And Joshua's story on KUOW.org will have a link to how you can get involved in that process. I'm Libby Denkman, back in a minute with more Soundside.